This is the Apartment Building Investing Podcast with Michael Blanc. Let's go!
You're listening to the Apartment Building Investing Podcast, where we'll talk about all aspects of buying apartment buildings with a special focus on raising money from others. And now, your host, Michael Blanc.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the show. I just want to start by just saying thank you. Thank you for all your support, for all the listeners, and the emails, and the affirmation that what we're doing is worthwhile. I just want to give a shout out to a 5-star review on iTunes. This handle is Rich and Blessed. Isn't that the case? He says, I just wanted to thank you for putting out great content, especially for those like myself who are just getting started out and feel overwhelmed and not knowing where to start. I'm also learning a lot through using the syndicated analyzer. God bless. All the best. I appreciate it. Rich and Blessed, thanks so much for your support. If you have a few minutes, I'd love to get your review on iTunes. Just go to iTunes and search for Michael Blanc and just leave a quick review, and I'll shout it out next time. If you're enjoying the podcast, I have a lot of other free content as well. The best way to get to all that is through the website, themichaelblanc.com. And if you go to the About page, you can see a link to all of my biggerpockets.com articles, as well as, of course, the podcast, the YouTube channel, and my own blog articles as well. And make sure you download the free ebook, which talks about how to raise private money to fund your next apartment building deal. All right, so today we have Michael Becker on the show. And he's a fascinating guy because he was in the business. He was a banker and started getting into commercial real estate loans. And one day figured out that, you know, why is he funding deals for everybody else? Why doesn't he get into the business himself? And it's not an easy transition to make, because I know plenty of commercial lenders and bankers who are so averse to risk they would never even consider it, even though they're experts. They have a track record. They probably know more about the deal than some of the investors themselves. So today he'll take us on his journey, and we focused really in on how he got started and what he did to raise money and find deals. So, you know, we're going to talk about leveraging your current skill set to launch your real estate career. We all have some kind of skill set that we can leverage. Some have more relevant than others, but really, what are your current skill sets that can help you launch your career? Then we talked about mindset, you know, the importance of adjusting your mindset from a 9-to-5 W-2 employee to entrepreneur. That's not an easy transition to make. And what are some of the other aspects of mindset? For example, dealing with uncertainty and being uncomfortable. And we talked about why it's important to think big to succeed. You just got to think big. And Michael definitely is thinking big. Why you need to transition from using your own money to raising it from others as soon as possible. Now, Michael had some of his own money, but because of the deal sizes he's doing, he's quickly exhausted it. And he only was able to make that transition by considering partnerships, which he didn't. He did a bunch of single family landlording, buy and hold stuff that he did by himself, but he couldn't have done the scale that he's doing. I mean, his first unit was 120 unit that he bought. And that was enabled by a partnership who then subsequently funded three other deals. And this was something he had not considered before. He didn't want to do any partnerships. He's got some great tips for finding off-market deals. He's buying in Texas right now, but really the market is tight all over the place. And he's got a really interesting tip that I think you will, is something that we can all learn from and implement. And he's going to share that with us. He's going to talk about some of the difference between, you know, what successful investors he sees and those who actually never get out of the gate. He also talks about recognizing a good deal. I asked him quite a bit about, you know, how does he recognize a good deal? What's a good cash-on-cash return for the investors and overall return? He talks about the importance of good debt. And I asked him, well, what does that mean exactly? So he's going to talk about what good debt is versus just okay debt and kind of why that's important. And he also talks about some of the personal habits that contribute to his success. Michael is a partner at Old Capital, where he provides funding for commercial real estate deals. But a year ago, he made a transition basically full-time into commercial real estate, apartment building specifically, and went from zero to about 1,000 units in that first year, with about another 200 to close in the next 45 days. His goal for next year is to add another 1,500 units to that. He and his team focus on light value add multifamily properties, so Class C, Types B in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and he raises money out of Southern California. and uses exclusively Fannie Mae debt. He talks about why that is important. So as a result, he's very familiar with all aspects of the transaction process, including underwriting, marketing, financial analysis, due diligence, and preparation of marketing materials, as well as processing and closing. So with that, let's just get right into the show.
Hey, Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, so I'm really excited you're on the show today because we all want to learn from each other, and I think you have lots of experience and some lessons learned and success stories to share. So why don't you start by talking a little bit about yourself and just your business and what you're doing now, and then we'll follow it up with kind of how you got started with real estate.
Sure, yeah. I'm a banker by profession, so I grew up in the banks and was a commercial real estate lender for several years. And what I'm doing now is I've transitioned out of that, and I'm into raising money and buying apartment complexes in the DFW area. So we as of today, I have about 1,000 units, and I have about another 200 in escrow that should close in another 2 weeks or so. So it's pretty exciting times right now.
So you've actually made the transition from being banker commercial lender, and you're doing this now full time.
Correct. Yeah, I'm my primary focus is on raising money and buying apartment complexes in the DFW area.
That's fantastic. Now, a lot of our listeners are interested in getting into multifamily or doing some small duplex, quads, things of that nature. I think back in the very beginning. How did you get started with commercial real estate investing yourself? What are some of the steps leading up to that?
Yeah, honestly, really started one day. I just had a really, really bad day, and I decided it was time to do something about it. So what happened was, I was a long time, over a decade, working in the banks as a commercial real estate lender, and I filed my taxes one year, and I realized I couldn't even itemize. And then I kind of sit back and, realize I'm just a W-2 stiff. And I look at all these people I've been loaning money to for years and years, and they're, getting rich, making a lot of money, and they pay next to nothing in tax. So that was really the kind of the threshold moment for me was I made my mind up that day I was going to do something different. And in about 3 months from that day, I bought my first property, which I started out, doing some small single-family houses and ended up doing 15 of them at my peak. And that's just kind of how I got started, was I just had a really bad day one day. So
you had a really bad day, and you started to get into real estate and flip some houses.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't really flipping. I bought them. I bought them for cash flow. I always focused on cash flow. So I bought for rentals, and I held them for a few years. And then this year I decided I was going to kind of sell everything. So I've sold basically everything. So I just, just always focused on cash flow and just decided I wanted to, find a way that, if I was flipping houses, that really wasn't a very tax efficient way of going about it. But if I owned investment real estate, that cash flow that I could depreciate and write off all the expenses and, and it certainly worked. I went from, paying a bunch of taxes, and the next year I got a big old tax refund when I wrote off a whole bunch of depreciation and a lot of the work I was doing to the properties.
Right, exactly right. Now, you felt you needed to do single family houses. Did it occur to you to go right into multifamily, or was you just weren't thinking along those lines?
No, I did think about it, but when I got started, it was 2011. And being a commercial real estate lender, the previous 3 years from that point were not a whole lot of fun, and my perspective as a banker kind of tainted my view of partnerships to start, and I wanted to do everything on my own, and I knew I could do a bunch of little single family houses on my own. I didn't want to get right out of the gate into partnerships, and after doing it for several years, I realized that every time I bought a house, I was kind of buying myself another management problem, and it wasn't very scalable. And then after a few years of doing that, I transitioned into kind of using my knowledge as a banker into doing syndications, being leading the deal, and just kind of using all my connections from being an apartment lender for years and years, and just kind of made the transition, kind of played my little personal game of Monopoly, I guess.
Right. Did you manage the properties yourself, or did you have a property manager do all that for you?
Right. When I had all my little houses, I managed them all myself. And then when we do apartments, I hire a professional third-party management company. So it's a heck of a lot easier for me to own, you know, over 1,000 units than it is for me to own, you know, 15 rent houses. I get a lot less headaches from my apartments than I do my rent houses.
Interesting. Well, what are some of the things that you learned from a single-family house that you felt prepared you well for a multifamily?
You know, more than anything, it just kind of got my mindset changed. You know, I was, you know, kind of beaten in my head from my parents, you know, to save money and get a good job and go to school and all that stuff. And it was just really a mentality shift to, you know, taking on debt. You know, good debt that produces income, or to buy real estate that produces income, is good debt. And, you know, having a mentality shift. So that was one of the biggest things for me. And then it's really just kind of, you know, getting in real world situations and, you know, running across some, you know, problems, and then, you know, having to, you know, solve them, really. And that's kind of gave me the confidence that I can then, you know, progress up and take on bigger and bigger challenges.
Yeah, I mean, do you have like a story of kind of a setback or challenge, or maybe even an outright failure while you were holding these things that you share?
I did have the second house I bought. I learned the hard way that, you know, you need to do pretty extensive plumbing checks, and so in the second house I bought, I did a bunch of foundation work, because in my part of Texas we have some clay soil that moves, so foundation issues are relatively common over here. And and I didn't check out the sewer system after I did it, and we moved a tenant in who happened to be an attorney, so I learned not to do my best to lease attorneys, and we had a whole bunch of sewer issues. It turned out I had to replace like 20 foot of sewer pipe right underneath the middle of the house, and it was a slab foundation. So he ended up moving out and sending me a few threatening letters, and, you know, but he ultimately went away. I got someone else in there, fixed the issue, and kind of moved on. But it's just really kind of reinforced to me the, you know, which I take today is, you know, your physical inspection and being absolutely thorough and detailed on your physical inspections. Because if you go into these deals, and, you know, fortunately I wasn't undercapitalized, but if you're undercapitalized and you hit a big setback like that, it could cripple you. So, you know, just knowing what you're buying and having enough capital to go forward is very critical.
That's exactly right, because let's say you had to do this and you didn't have the capital to do it. I mean, what option you have? You know, I don't know, let the house go, foreclose on it or whatever, because you went to violations that you can't remedy. Yeah, that's
very true.
I mean,
that's how.
Yeah, that's a good advice about having a capital reserve.
Oh, yeah, that's how a lot of people got in trouble in the last down cycle. They just over-leveraged, didn't have any reserves, and one little problem can send them down the spiral that they just can't recover from.
Yeah, exactly. Now, at what point did you wake up and say, okay, I'm kind of done with this, I want to do multifamilies? What happened?
Well, you know, then again, I was still loaning money, and just one day, you know, just kind of, I one of my clients, I lent money to a few years prior, back in, I think, 2010, 2011. It was based out of the Los Angeles area, and my market, quite a large percentage of the apartment complex are owned by people from Southern California, and they had a need that I saw, that they needed some local help, like boots on the ground, to kind of asset manage these properties for them, help them qualify for better debt. And, you know, they had a void. So I just reached out to them one day and, you know, realized that if I can do that, I can, you know, not only, you know, leverage our money by putting equity in and getting a loan, but I can, you know, then, you know, put my money in at a discount and then, you know, make money pretty much day one as the lead in a deal. And it's kind of the light bulb went off that, you know, I can do a whole lot of those. And every time I keep buying these houses, and, you know, I think it was summertime and my HVACs were going out, and, you know, I just got a call after call after call, and I just kind of got sick of dealing with it. I just kind of decided to make the move to go from, you know, from this and try out to do apartments.
So you, at that point, let's talk about your first deal. What was the first deal that you did?
Sure. I bought a 120-unit apartment complex in a part of Dallas called Garland, and it was a mid-70s construction, and the previous ownership group had owned it for, you know, quite a long time, and we were able to find the deal off-market, so it wasn't listed by a broker. and the property needed, you know, about $4,000 a unit and repairs and upgrades to go in. And so we bought the property, and it was pretty well occupied. It was, you know, 95-96% on average occupied. So it was pretty good, but their rents were low and the property needed some work. And so we thought we were about 15% under market rents. So we bought the property and you know, come in and subsequently done all the upgrades and, you know, really pushed revenue quite a bit. And you know, we're actually contemplating selling the property now. And we got a pretty big gain in there. We believe at least a double up.
Yeah, that's outstanding. And did you raise the money for that, or did you use the proceeds from your single family houses to fund that? How did you fund it on the equity side?
Yeah, so I put in a little bit of the money, and then the group out of California put in the rest. So you know, they put in the vast majority of the money, and then we actually bought it with a Fannie Mae loan, so a non-recourse 10-year loan on a 30-year amortization. So they'll give you, you know, up to 80%. So I think we got, you know, 80% or darn close to it.
Yeah, that's outstanding. And so it sounds like you had some issues with it early on, but they were fairly well managed by your management team that you had in place.
Yeah, so the properties that we target are, you know, like I kind of alluded to, pretty well occupied, but are, you know, have, you know, management issues or physical issues, or in pretty much every case both of them. And so what we you know, the management company comes in and handles, you know, the management issues. So we're pretty strict in the way we go about enforcing procedures and protocols. And so, you know, the previous ownership group was pretty lax on, say, collections is a good example. They let people kind of just pay as they go, you know, whenever they want throughout the month, where, you know, where it's pretty black and white with us, where your rent's due on the 1st and you start getting late fees on the 4th and we start filing evictions and things like that if you don't pay. So we had, you know, the upheaval on the management side, and then, you know, I was primarily responsible for the capital projects on the exterior of the building. So, you know, we did, you know, quite a bit of carpentry work and stucco repair and put new roofs on it and parking lot and, you know, quite a bit of concrete work and things like that. And then as these units turn, the management company oversees, you know, upgrading the interiors with new appliances and flooring and plumbing and light fixtures and et cetera.
Yeah. Now, you changed your mind about partnerships, it sounds like, because that's what you did. How come?
Yeah. You know, it just kind of finally dawned on me, you know, that I just, it's just a lot of work when you're going out there on your own. And if you can get, you know, a partnership and, you know, you can just kind of pool your resources and divide and conquer your time, and you can do a whole lot more when you kind of take that approach versus trying to do everything yourself. And, you know, I couldn't get to where I wanted to without doing it. And, you know, every time I kept buying a house, I just, you know, I just bought myself another little mini job every single time. And then one day I don't want to have that many jobs. So I decided that this was the better approach for me.
Now, how did you guys split up your roles? Was this these guys out of LA kind of silent partners, or did they have a lead role? And what was your role versus them? How did you kind of structure that in your partnership?
Yeah, the way I am the lead, I'm the managing member of the deal. And, you know, so I'm kind of responsible for all the ownership function. So I kind of describe it as I take the ownership off the money. So they put in most of the money, and then, you know, I oversee the management company. I oversee the upfront capital improvements. But, you know, the management company is really the one out there that hires all the employees and deals with collections and repair, you know, work orders and city issues and things like that. And then I just kind of got to make sure that they're on top of it. And then at the end of the year, you know, I file the tax returns, and then I'm kind of the communication liaison between the, you know, the money investors and, you know, the, you know, and then the operations of the property.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're basically silent investors. It sounds to me like you're only the asset manager as well as you're managing the manager, but they're largely silent then, it sounds like. It's not like they're,
for the most part,
telling you,
correct,
what to do. Yeah. For the most part. Exactly. Now, what, looking back on it, what did you have any lessons learned? Because this is kind of your first unit. I know you've been dealing with, you know, commercial lending, so you had some level of comfort level, but you know, the first 120 unit out of the gate is probably did you feel it was a pretty large step taking the 120, or was that well within your comfort zone?
You know, it was on the edge of my comfort zone for sure. Just the level of communication that is needed, and you know, when you're doing this and you're asking people for the money, and particularly when it's your first time, you don't have a track record per se. You know, you get asked some pretty challenging questions along the way. So I was glad I had a little bit of a background in the banking, but you know, just really. You know, just getting put in some pretty uncomfortable situations, some questions pre-close, and you know, just kind of going through the full cycle. You know, I was involved with a lot of these types of syndications, just being a vendor, being the banker, but you know, being the guy that had to put it together, go through the legal negotiations, and you know, all those you know, things was a pretty eye-opening experience for me, and you know, kind of. Once I got through it, you know, it kind of just bolstered my confidence, and you know, it gets easier and easier every time I do one now.
Yeah. Well, what kind of is a good point? I mean, you were sort of in the business, but you didn't have a track record. How did you kind of overcome that as you spoke with, you know, I guess some of your investors and other professionals on the team? What did you do to kind of gain that credibility with them?
Sure. You know, I definitely played on my real estate ownership experience and the rehab, and then the rehab projects I've taken on, because you know, the project we were buying definitely needed some work. So kind of my ability to manage that, and then just really played on my professional background, being around it and being in the market, you know, and then specifically in my case, you know, the people we deal with predominantly are out of, you know, 1500 miles away out of California, and you know, the properties are here in Dallas, and they recognize that it's going to be challenging for them to do it remotely. So they really need, or feel they need some help in the market with, you know, people that kind of oversee all the little things that go on and be on top of it. And, you know, we just kind of sold the value of that. And then, you know, they ultimately, I'm putting in most of the money, you know, while I'm the managing member, they ultimately, if they don't like what I'm doing, they can come in and replace me, because, you know, they control the deal ultimately. So, yeah. You know, that was one of the things I kept harping on, that, you know, kind of gave them the comfort that, you know, anytime you don't like me, you got the power to vote me out. So.
That's an interesting way to address that objection. Hey, look, if you don't like me, if I screw up because of my whatever quote unquote lack of track record, hey, you can vote me off the island. And it sounds
right.
Like that's what you did, and they felt good about that.
Yep, they did. And then now, you know, now that we got a track record, it gets, you know, a little bit better and a little bit better every time for us. And you know, we have more and more control of these deals the more and more we do.
Exactly. Well, the more and more tracker you build up, the more you can ask for.
That's right. And that first, and that, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, I really focused on was, you know, I made my mind up that I wanted to not be a banker and I wanted to get in the business full time. And so, you know, I took what, you know, was less of a deal for me being the sponsor. You know, I'm making less money than you know, someone else might want to do. But, you know, I want to do a whole lot of deals real quick. And so I wanted to build my track record up. So that was a conscious thing, that I was taking less today to kind of build my business so I can have, you know, a better tomorrow. And that was a conscious decision, that I just wanted to get to critical mass as quick as possible. So my goal was 1,000 units within the first year, and I hit it.
That's amazing. Before we go on to that, because I want to hear all about that, but what were some of your mistakes that you think you made on that 120 unit, or some lessons learned you had?
You know, I don't have a ton on that specific deal. I think we've done a pretty good job on that specific deal. We had a deal before that with a different group that didn't work out for one or another reasons, but the you know, speaking at first, I was misspeaking some when I was going out there trying to raise money, and just really, you know, kind of playing on more my experience as a professional vendor versus my ownership and some smaller properties, and I got some pushback from a previous investor group, and the deal ultimately didn't work out. And you know, I kind of took some lessons that, you know, just really need to play on my experience and what I've done, and you know, that I've owned it, and you know, that we can, you know, that I'll do the right thing, and you know, again, that they can always maintain control. That was one of the things that I learned from the first failed equity raise on a deal.
So let's talk about that. So this was a deal that you tried to raise money for, but you were unable to close on a deal. Is that what happened?
Yeah, so we ended up terminating because the physical inspections went bad on the property. But I was getting some pushback along the way from a different set of investors, and a lot of it was I wasn't speaking with some confidence, and I wasn't instilling confidence into them with my approach. And so I kind of went back in, analyzed what I was doing wrong, and then came back with a different approach, and that's what I kind of use now. And like we talked about, the more and more I do, the better track record I have, and the easier and easier this becomes.
Yeah, that's very, very important, dealing with confidence. But I'm a little surprised that was an issue, especially after doing 120 unit. That just proves that that's important. How you approach the investors is so key.
Yeah, definitely.
So what did you do? What did you do from there? I think you said that your goal was 1,000 units in 1 year. And how did you proceed from that? Did you leverage your relationship with this LA-based group and went out and just is that your primary funding, or how did you raise more money for?
Yeah, that was basically it. So the next three deals was with that same group. They have quite a bit of equity, and we got one done. The second deal, I had a group of four different individuals that were kind of lifelong friends, and they pulled their money with us, and we bought a 160 unit deal, also in the same submarket, different part, but the same submarket over there. Again, it was a value, kind of like a light value add play, but it's pretty well occupied. And then we've bought a 255 unit, 260 unit property, all in, and we bought that in what, March and May of this year. Both those needed quite a bit of work, and the third deal we bought needed quite a bit of foundation work, and needed 880 piers of foundation, which is a lot. And so, kind of we got our money partner was the same money partner that was in the first deal, and he got comfortable with us because, we have a background in foundation and all these things that I did in my single family houses. I was able to speak pretty intelligently about, how it works, and, he got confidence that we can, solve the issue, and it's not a fatal blow.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like you leveraged that one relationship into at least two or three other deals. And the one that you did, the 160 unit, was through friends and family, basically, or people that you knew. But the rest was done through this one money partner.
Yeah, and then they were friends of family based out of there, and then they kind of pulled their money with us. So it was all out of this one relationship I made. After that, that's when I decided I did all that, by the way, when I had a full-time job. And at that point is when I decided to leave banking, which was in June of this year. And I formed a new partnership with one of the guys that was in that group, and we started our own company. And then just here recently, we bought our last deal, 160 unit deal, and a submarket called Denton, which is just a little bit north of DFW. So that was our first deal as a new company that we closed about 2 weeks ago. So we ended up, doing that with all new relationships. We didn't, some of them were based out of there in California, and then some of them were based here in Texas. And we were able to, raise about $1.8 million. To buy this deal in Denton. So it was a pretty big step that, the four we did with this one group out of Los Angeles, and this last one we did kind of on our own without their help. So it was a pretty big step to get the first deal across the goal line on kind of on our own.
So it's interesting. I mean, it sounds like you're the original financing partners out of LA, you kind of stumbled on a little bit, right? I mean, you kind of came across and you kind of fell into it a little bit, if I understand correctly. But this last round, you actually had to go out and raise the money. Can you talk more about what your approach was, that you actually had to go and find new money?
Yeah, so that was, like you said, the first deal I kind of stumbled across, and the equity was just kind of taken care of for the most part for me, and I had to be involved a little bit in it, but I wasn't the guy driving the ship by any means. And then on this one, we thought that one of the groups that we had already previously done a deal for was going to fund the equity, and they ended up not wanting to do it after we had the deal under contract. So, one day I had to wake up and scramble and dial a whole bunch of people and raise $1.8 million. So we ended up doing it in about a week. And it was just really, just a lot of hard work and being organized and knowing our deal and knowing that we had a good deal. And, you know, it just kind of proves if you got a deal, the money will find it. You know, if you're out there working it, and that's certainly what we did. So it was, but it was definitely a little bit different being the guy that was, you know, was in charge of raising all the money and having to do it on my own and being the lead in the pitch for sure.
Right. Well, who did you call? I mean, obviously you said, okay, I got to raise $1.8 million, and you probably had some commitments with existing relationships probably, but then there's a little bit of a gap. What did you do? Who did you call to kind of try to bridge that gap?
Sure. So a lot of the people that I, a couple of the people, just people that I knew in the market that just kind of by being around, being a banker that, you know, I've gone to, you know, both being a banker, then I've gone to, you know, several like local RIA. I'm a member of a local RIA and I go kind of get networked. And so two of the people I got through this local RIA that I kind of had, you know, been friendly with for a long time, and I knew they had some money and were interested. So, you know, called them up, presented the deal, and they liked it, and we ended up, you know, doing it. And then a couple of the people were out of California that my partner kind of had stumbled across, and, you know, we just kind of, you know, they were new to us, so we just hadn't done a deal with them. And then we, you know, just ended up calling them through, you know, through his connections and relationships out there, and you know, we ended up closing them that way. But we had, I think, 7 partners in this last deal we did, where most of the previous ones were, you know, typically 1 or 2. But the, you know, 1 to 4 was kind of the largest we'd done before, but they were typically, you know, 1 or 2 people in the past. So, you know, it was a little bit more challenging, and I know a lot of people out there raising money have to have, you know, 30, 40, 50 partners. So I could only imagine how much fun that is calling 50 people for money. So
yeah, I try to keep mine to 10 or less because, you know, there's going to be at least 2 going to be a pain in the butt.
That's right. That's right.
That's funny. Now, how are you guys? I mean, obviously, raising money, there's normally 2 big challenges, right? Normally, one is raising the money, and the other one is finding the deals. And I know a lot of people across the country are really having a tough time finding deals. How are you guys finding deals right now?
Yeah, so we previously we've done the first 4 deals I did, we kind of did a combination of on and off market, about 2 and 2. And then now, you know, the market's so competitive in Texas and DFW specifically that, you know, it's hard. And every time these deals get on market, they seemingly get bid up and the price kind of gets away from us a little bit. So we just can't make as much sense as we would like them to. So we really just kind of focused on off-market deals, and how we kind of go about that. Really, just kind of, you know, I'm reasonably networked in the industry, just being, you know, being a banker for a long time and loaning on a bunch of these deals. So just kind of leveraging my relationships with a lot of the brokers in the area and just kind of reaching out to them and having them, you know, identify an area, or we'll pull some target properties and start working with them to call on these ownership groups and see if they would, you know, be willing to accept a, you know, an off-market offer without going full bore. So what we kind of identify or try to identify are properties that are, you know, if they have long-term ownership, that helps. If they're owner operated, so they self-manage, that helps. And you know, usually after a while, you know, I kind of one of my mentors in the business kind of describes, you know, apartment ownerships is kind of like owning them in dog years, you know. So when you own a deal for, you know, 10 years, that's a really, really long time in apartment ownership time. So, you know, these people have owned them for a long time, the basis is a little bit lower, and, you know, they self-manage, they don't want to go through the whole process of trying to list the property and having, you know, 20, 30 property tours and, you know, subjecting the staff to, you know, God knows what kind of questions along the way. And they're a little bit more apt to just kind of sell discreetly off market. So those are kind of the people that we target, and, you know, target the properties that are in the market that are kind of lagging in rents compared to the other ones that we know that we can come in and, you know, do a little bit of work. And we believe we have a little bit upside in the rental rates. So that's kind of basically how we go about it.
That's interesting, Michael. So you're actually calling your network of brokers to do quote unquote the cold calling for you.
We find that a little bit more effective. You know, a lot of people do the letters or call on their own. You know, there's got to be a commission in it the way that we do it. But I mean, these guys, all they do all day long is they're making 20, 30 phone calls every day. They're in the market. They know these owners better than I do. And, you know, a lot of times when you get in these deals, there's always something that happens. There's always something that comes up. And when you're dealing with the seller direct, I found that, you know, it's more of an adversarial relationship. And then if you have a broker in the middle, he's kind of the mediator, right? So we hit whatever issue that you hit, because there's always an issue. They can help kind of mediate the issue and overcome it. And you know, it just really improves the likelihood of closing the transaction. You know, so I'm not into this for practice. So, you know, every deal we get on a contract, we need to close, or we lose money on them. So that's kind of the approach that we've taken, and it seemed to work pretty good, because, you know, I only have so much time in the day, and I can get a dozen brokers out there calling for me, and they just, you know, I'm just calling them saying, what do you have? And then even if it's not the property that I sent them to target, sometimes it triggers something in their mind that, oh, well, this doesn't work, but I know this other guy that might sell. And that's kind of how we got the last two deals.
And how are you guys compensating the brokers? I mean, typically they want 5-6%. Are you getting them to agree to some lower percentage? Are you splitting that with the sellers, or how are you addressing that?
Yeah, so in the multifamily space here, when you start talking about, you know, bigger projects, you know, it's somewhere between 2-3% typically. Sometimes even a little bit lower, because, you know, you're talking about buying a $10 million property. That's a heck of a lot of money. And so the first deal, this deal we just closed, we ended up, you know, offering him a price, and that he would pay the broker, and he countered us that he would accept our price if we pay the broker, and we ended up just splitting it. And then this other deal that, you know, was very similar, that, you know, we agreed upon a price, and then that, you know, that price had us paying the commission to the broker. So we ended up just, you know, agreeing on a price and then grossing the contract up to, you know, where he pays it, but we, you know, raise the price to compensate him. So that's kind of, you know, how we did it. But I would never have gotten either deal on my own, you know, so I was happy to pay them, you know, quite a bit of money, because we never would have found the deal and never would have got it and never would have had my foot in the door if these guys weren't out there calling for us.
Well, that's right, and you're absolutely right. I mean, number one, it's their business. Number two, they know these owners, right? So they're probably going to be the first to know, number one, if someone wants to sell, and number two, they're more likely to take their call. And versus you, you're just, you know, who are you, right? So
that's right.
That's a very interesting approach. Off-market, always like, well, you, like you said, you send the letters, or another guy I know actually cold calls owners. Had some success with that as well. But that's
and, you know, he might save a few dollars, but I can do a lot more deals than he can. I know that.
So. Well, I can see that. And that, you know, the other part of this stuff is finding deals, but the other one is kind of, what kind of returns are you looking for when you underwrite a deal? And yeah, how do you define that? Say, how do you know when it's a good deal?
Yeah, so what we look for, you know, what we've done, like I said, we look for deals with a little bit of value add to it, a little bit of upside in the rents, or that we can, you know, that they aren't presently billing back utilities, and we can, you know, implement what's called RUBS, which is ratio utility billing system. So we can implement basically, like, on a lot of these older properties, the water is master metered, so the property pays for it. So we'll implement, you know, kind of taking a ratio and billing back a, you know, a certain percentage, where, you know, depending on what type of unit you're in, you're going to spend $30 or $40 on the water bill that you pay back to the property. So there's, you know, two ways that we can go in and increase revenue, primarily. One's through rent and one's through utility bill back. So we kind of focus on properties that neither don't bill back utilities or under market rents, or, you know, usually both. You know, so the kind of the returns that we're focused on for investors, you know, we need a minimum, you know, kind of minimum cash on cash. We target at least double digits, at least 10%, you know, so 10, 12, 15%, somewhere in that kind of range. And then, you know, usually when we buy these deals that have, you know, that are under market, you know, 15% rents, or they don't bill back utilities, you know, usually you can come in and increase NOI quite a bit by raising the top line and doing, you know, some expense savings. You know, one of the biggest expense savings we do is water conservation, you know, because water is a pretty big expense on the property. So implementing, like, low flow, you know, shower heads and aerators on the faucets, and then changing out the guts in the toilet. So they fixing leaks and changing out the guts in the toilet. So it just kind of restricts the usage of water. And, you know, and the way apartments are valued is, you know, every you know, dollar you saved, I mean, it's in my market today is about a multiple of 12 to value. So every dollar we can save to the bottom line is about $12 of value. So, you know, if we can go in and by a combination of raising revenue and lowering expenses, you know, most of these properties, you know, we can increase the value, you know, hopefully between somewhere between 50 and 100% of our equity amount. within the first, you know, 2 to 3 years. And the way we buy these deals are with Fannie Mae loans. So we can either sell the property or we can take what they call a supplemental. So they allow you to re-leverage a loan, kind of do a cash out without having to pay off the first mortgage. So, you know, we look to have a liquidity event, you know, somewhere between, you know, 50 and 100% of our equity in the first, you know, 2 to 3 years on top of low double-digit cash-on-cash returns.
Yeah, that's interesting. And now, what kind of returns are you trying to achieve for your equity investors? And sometimes that is
for the equity investors, that they get low double-digit cash-on-cash returns and hopefully can have a liquidity event either through sale or through a supplemental that, you know, will be somewhere around 50 to 100%, you know, capital gain or return of equity within the first, you know, 2 to 3 years.
So you're looking for investor cash and cash return of about 12%, but then an overall return would be how much for the investors, assuming a liquidity event sale?
You know, I don't typically present it as an IRR because it's kind of hard to do, but I would imagine that would equate out in the 30-35% range, I would imagine. But there's a lot of things that are hard to control. We don't ever really, you know, try to quantify exactly what the liquidity event would be. But, you know, one thing that, you know, that makes sense, that, you know, that's how these deals work, is just cash flow. So we just really focus when I'm out, you know, pitching deals just on cash on cash returns. That's the most conservative approach, and that's, you know, as long as you have cash flow, you can pretty much survive anything. So that's what we always focus on, is just cash on cash and the cash flow in the deal.
And do you typically pay out a preferred rate of return when you do that as well?
No, we haven't done that. We just kind of, you know, we'll take a little bit of the deal, and then we just kind of pay out everything, you know, pro rata based on ownership. So that's kind of how we've taken our model. I know a lot of the deal sponsors will pay, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 pref, and then, you know, have the waterfall, what they call waterfall split on the back end. Yep. So after the pref is current, they'll pay, you know, 50-50 to the sponsor and then the rest of the investors or whatever the split is. But we just kind of focus on keeping it a little bit more straightforward and simple, and just, you know, we'll take a little percentage of the deal, we'll put some money in the deal on top of that, and then everyone just kind of owns what they own. And then if we make a $10,000 distribution, it's kind of just split out by, you know, ownership percentage.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a key to keep it simple. And, you know, you said don't talk about an IRR because it confuses people, which I found as well. And you just want to keep it simple with a simple split. The pref gets kind of complicated.
One is complicated. You know, I'm not that smart, so we just keep it simple. And then two, you know, you can monkey with, you know, a lot of people put, you know, aggressive rent growth projections in their models, or they, you know, all these things that you can monkey to make your IRR look good. But we just really focus on finding good deals under market, raising rents, controlling expenses, and, you know, getting good debt. And if, as long as you have good debt, that, you know, that helps quite a bit. And then, you know, then at the end of the day, you're cash on cash. We haven't had any problems yet identifying properties that we can't get, you know, low double-digit cash on cash returns.
Now, just to be clear here, though, if you're giving an investor a low-digit cash on cash return, let's say whatever 12%, then the actual property is going to have to cash flow much higher than that. Otherwise, you as a syndicator won't get paid anything. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the properties did. That's after, you know, all dilution and fees and everything. So, you know, we got to find these properties that work a little bit better than that. And, you know, so yeah, they work a little bit better than that, and then we're compensated out of it. And then at the end of the day, the investor still can get that. So, you know, really, one of the things that, you know, we do pretty better than the next guy, I think, is just really working with the lender, focusing on it and getting the absolute best debt out there possible. And that really, really helps your cash on cash returns.
When you say good debt, I mean, what are you talking about? What should people look for under good debt? Certainly the interest rate is there, but what are some of your other considerations when you say, I want good debt?
Yeah, so, you know, we pretty much exclusively to date have done Fannie Mae loans. So, you know, you can't, if you're getting into the business, you got to have a track record before you can get, you know, Fannie Mae loans. They don't loan to first timers. So, you know, most people have to start off getting a loan from, you know, a local bank and sign personal recourse. But, you know, when you kind of can graduate up and get Fannie Mae loans, I mean, they'll do 80% of cost. They'll allow you to roll up to 3% of closing costs into it, as well as up to $5,000 a door in capital improvements. So we can roll all that into total cost, and they'll give you up to 80% of that. It's just really a matter of finding the deals that, you know, have the upside, but they're well occupied to qualify for the loan, and just really working with the lender and, you know, kind of presenting our case and our plan and our capital, you know, our capital plan and our operating plan, and get their buy-in that they have confidence in us that we're going to be able to deliver that, and you know, and they'll give us, you know, good leverage. And it's a 10, you know, we always do 10-year fixed rate loans, and we get the first year is you know, always have been interest only. So, you know, allows you a little bit of time the first year while you're repositioning it, not to have as large of a debt service payment, and, you know, gives you 12 months to get your stuff together, get the property looking good, and start implementing the, you know, the revenue increases.
Yeah, that's awesome. So higher level a little bit here, Michael, think about, have you ever had a kind of an aha moment when you kind of woke up and said, oh my goodness, and a light bulb went off?
Yeah, I mean, you know, going back, I mean, really, like I said, it was that one bad day, you know, really made me reflect and, you know, what am I doing here? You know, I'm working and saving money, and, you know, all I'm doing is, you know, working for the government and paying taxes. And that was the day that I really kind of got started. But, you know, the aha moment when I really wanted to transition into to syndicating was, you know, being a banker and making a lot of apartment loans for these, for, you know, deal syndicators, you know, I just kind of really started paying attention to a lot of these guys, and, you know, just realized that, you know, a lot of these people I was loaning money to, I had, you know, a lot more knowledge and a lot more, you know, connections, and, you know, I knew more about this deal than they did, and they're out there doing it, and I was kind of just sitting working my job. And it was just kind of one of these days that was like, you know, if they've, you know, not that all these people weren't smart, but, you know, like, but it just kind of kicked me in the butt a little bit that, you know, if they can do it, I know I could do it. And then, you know, I kind of saw some of the money some of these people were making, and I was like, if they can do that, you know, I could do as good or better. And just kind of, you know, just one day I just decided I need to just bet on myself and go out and, you know, take a shot at it, and wish I would have done it, you know, years and years ago. But, you know, you can always look back, but I'm glad I've done it, and excited about, you know, what we're doing and the prospects of the future.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, you said earlier that your goal was 1,000 units, and I think you used the word, you know, for a better tomorrow. In your mind, with 1,000 units, what does that allow you to do? How does that help you achieve what are your goals that you want to achieve with that?
You know, so the 1,000 units, well, one, it kind of was enough to cover my base every month with, you know, having a mortgage, a wife, and a couple kids, and a couple car payments. You know, I had some obligations. So, you know, one, it was enough to, you know, should be enough to be sustainable from that perspective. And then two, it really just in the short term just gave me, you know, everyone knew me in this one role, and it really just kind of put in their minds that, you know, well, heck, Mike Becker's out there doing this, and he's got 1,000 units. I need to take him serious. Because once you hit that mark, I mean, there's a lot of guys that have a deal or two, but when you're out there with that many units, it really kind of takes you into the next level, and at least in my mind, from perception of what other people did. And, you know, kind of my goal next year is that we want to do, you know, at least 8 deals next year. And, you know, we're averaging, you know, a little bit over 200 units every time we do it. So that'll be 1,600, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 units next year where we should be able to do. And we'll start turning full cycle. The first several deals we've done should kind of go full cycle next year. That's one of my other goals, is to take at least 2 of them full cycle and sell them as well.
Yeah, exactly. Where do you kind of, I mean, you're moving pretty rapidly here, Mike. So what are your kind of your 5 or maybe even 10-year goals? Where do you kind of see this going longer term?
You know, that's kind of hard to quantify a little bit for me. I mean, I think, you know, I'm just really focused on next year. I mean, I think the more I do, the more I want to do. But at a certain point, it's going to, you know, we're having to scale. So right now there's a total of 3 of us in my company, my partner and I, and we have one guy working with us, and we're going to hire another full-time employee, and then probably next year hire another one. And so just about, you know, I just really need to, you know, constantly look back and constantly, you know, make sure we can manage the growth. That's part of the any sort of startup, I believe. Just, you know, you can be successful and do a lot of deals, but if you can't manage them after you do them, it's gonna, you know, Rome's gonna burn a little bit. So we need to make sure that we're on top of it and managing the growth, and, you know, really just staying disciplined on the deals we're doing and not getting, you know, caught up in the hype of the market and just doing deals just to do deals. But we got to make sure, you know, we do the right deals, because if, you know, you have one go bad on you, it really hurts, and it's hard to recover from.
Yeah, that's true. Do you think you have a personal kind of habit that contributes to your ongoing success, something that you share with people?
Yeah, I was, kind of back to the last push. I do set kind of medium, short and medium term goals, and constantly looking back, or every day, every week, am I doing activities today or this week? Did I do anything that helped me move forward towards achieving my goals? So I'm constantly looking back and making sure the activities I'm doing are the proper ones to help me achieve what I want to achieve. So that's one of my I think my best habits that I do.
So reflecting and kind of looking back and to see if you're doing the right things or if you should be doing some other things. So basically looking back and reflecting a little bit.
Yeah. Self-analyze, make sure that, I'm trying to take a critical eye to myself and try to be real with myself, that I'm not, just believing that I'm doing everything right, because I know there's always better ways to improve. And the other thing I do, I'm always talking to other people that do what I do and trying to learn things from what they do. I don't know everything, and the market is constantly a fluid thing, and everything changes. And, I'm now my mid to late 30s now, and, there's a whole new generation out there that want different things than I wanted, and making sure that, we're trying to stay on top of what the market's going to do going forward, so that we're, not going to be caught with the pants down and, try to offer one product when everyone wants something else.
Yeah. So cool. We're about to wrap things up here. How can people find you if they want to contact you for any reason?
Sure. Yeah, there's two ways. So you can email me. My email is mbecker@spiadvisory.com. That's mbecker@spiadvisory.com. Or you can call me at the office at 214-675-2793.
2793. Cool. Any parting piece of advice for people to want to get into apartment building investing?
I think two things. One, you need to get at least a base level education. You're not born knowing how to do this stuff. So getting a good level education. One of the things a lot of people do if you're not kind of in the industry is they go to local real estate investment clubs that kind of focus on the asset class that you're trying to get into, and just really try to learn from others. And then the other thing is don't just keep getting your education forever, because you just need to get out there and take some action, because you're never going to know everything you need to know until you get out there and you start doing it. So just you're going to have to take action at some point, or you're never going to accomplish anything.
Speaking of local realtors, I see that quite a bit of people that will buy one course after another, but they actually never end up doing anything that they learn. It's so frustrating.
It is. And, at some point, you're just going to have to go out and actually take action. And if you as long as you buy something, that was what I did. I bought something small that I knew my wife was nervous about, but I knew would never cripple us financially. And then once, I kind of got the deal, rehabbed and leased, and kind of show proof of concept, it not only alleviated my wife's concerns, but it helped bolster my confidence that I can do this over and over and over again. And that's exactly what I've done.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Mike, I really appreciate your time and sharing your story with us.
All right, thanks for the interview, Michael.
All right, thank you.
Hey, thanks for joining me on the show today. I hope you found that useful and learned a lot. I really like the tip about using commercial real estate brokers to go after off-market deals. That's a very interesting strategy. I've heard derivatives, therefore, but not quite like that. And I think being intentional about that would be a great way to fill your pipeline. It doesn't require sending letters and cold calling people as well. So hopefully you found that useful. Speaking of being intentional, one of the key lessons is that we all need to be more intentional. If you're in a job that is okay, but it's not really fulfilling, it's not really what you want to do, just pay attention to that discontent and start doing something about it. Start taking steps like Michael has to do something about that. And you may have to do it in your spare time. It may take you a year or maybe longer to get going. But if you don't get started now, nothing will become of it. Anyway, thanks again for your time. Remember to go to themichaelblank.com/about. You can read about my story, of course, but also access all of the other free resources that I have available for you. Great. Thanks so much, and I'll catch you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Apartment Building Investing Podcast with Michael Blank. For more free podcasts, articles, and videos, go to themichaelblank.com. There, you can also download the free ebook, The Secret to Raising Money to Buy Your First Apartment Building. Till next time.